and welcome to the Your Ability podcast on this sunny Friday today. We've got, as always, a few people in the room who are going to hopefully have an interesting and exciting discussion with us. We have Will and Dave today. Most people who will have listened to the podcast now for a while will know both of them, but I am going to just briefly ask them to introduce themselves. So, Will, do you want to say hello?
Hello, my name is Will Cooling, and I'm the EDI partner at the Trust, and I'm also a member of the Disability Staff Network.
And Dave?
Hi, I'm Dave Stocks. I'm the co-chair of the Disability Staff Network.
So today's topic is somewhat broad. So we thought we'd talk about disability, which, as you can imagine, has lots of nuances and facets. So we are going to look to Will today to sort of give us some definitions, to talk us through some themes in disability, some ideas around legalities, things like that. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Will. Just to give a very high-level overview, and then we can have a discussion and a debate afterwards. So over to you, Will.
Yeah, so, you know, we should say we're recording this on a Friday afternoon, and I feel like our topic is very much a something you may consider it at the middle of the night, which is, you know, what is disability? What does it mean? And it's something that I've encountered throughout my time working in equality and diversity, which is you would encounter staff members who require support, meet the legal definition of disability, which I'll give in a second, but they themselves would not describe themselves as disabled, and so they begin to worry about whether they're actually entitled to the support they need. The Equality Act, I think, it's a pretty good definition of disability, and it's basically, do you have a physical or mental impairment that significantly, substantially affects your day-to-day activities for a prolonged time? That prolonged time is usually taken as 12 months, and that basically applies to the minute you acquire the impairment. So if you break your leg, for example, and you know, or it's reasonable to assume, it's going to take you a year to get over breaking your leg, for that period of time, you meet the legal definition of disability. Now, this is something I used to say in my previous job when I was doing staff inductions. Nobody would say that somebody broken their leg was disabled. They would say they'd broken their leg and that leg would heal.
Yeah.
And so the question then becomes, we've got this legal definition that guarantees rights and support, but what do we actually mean by disabled in a more everyday way of talking? What do we mean about by disability when it comes to doing things in the Disabled Staff Network or campaigns or celebrating culture? And I think it's one of those ones where there is no right answer, which should hopefully make for a good discussion.
Completely agree. I think it is about trying to give people confidence to say that they're disabled to meet the legality of the protection. But equally, as you rightly identified, and I think we've talked about this a little bit in previous podcasts, is that actually people don't see themselves as disabled. And I think, Dave, you yourself made the point that when you applied for jobs, you weren't even aware that mental health was covered under the Equality Act.
Yeah, you're right there, Chris. When I was originally diagnosed with a mental health condition, I had no idea that it was classed as a disability. It was only actually when I was signposted to applying for a leadership position at RADAR, which is Royal Association of Disability Rights, that I was then made to realise that mental health was a actual classed as a disability, and I was eligible to apply to go on this course. So, yeah, a lot of people don't actually realise that a condition they may have is actually classed as a disability, mental health being one of them.
Yeah. I think, Will, do you want to just talk us through briefly, because there are exceptions to that, aren't there? So, for example, cancer, I think, is classed as a disability straight away, isn't it? Whereby other disabilities would need to meet the 12-month threshold. I don't know if you want to talk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic way to think about it, and certainly for somebody listening to this podcast, is if you have a reasonable expectation that the issues you'll face are going to be for a prolonged period and going to stop you doing day-to-day activities, you'll be covered by the Disability Act. The 12 months is very much a piece of advice. In certain circumstances, it can be reduced down to 6 months. Yeah. I've even seen people argue it can be reduced down to 3 months. Yes, with things like cancer, I think HIV is another one as well.
Yeah, HIV.
It basically kicks in automatically, even if there's a possibility that actually the treatment will take will be quite quick, and it'll be only a few months until you're kind of the issues that affect your day-to-day life have been addressed. I think the interesting thing about the mental health is that I was always aware of that side because I'd struggled with my mental health when I was younger. I'd been involved in quite a lot of stuff at university in terms of supporting people's mental health. And this was in like the mid noughties. And so like mental health was like a big preoccupation of universities. I think it was like the first wave of like the post tuition fees generation, where like there was evidence that students were more stressed, were placing more pressure on themselves, needed more mental health support. So I've actually always been aware of that side. The thing that I've always struggled with is actually the boundary between what is not being well physically and being disabled physically. You know, bad backs were in my family, both my parents struggle, both my siblings struggle. I remember my dad's a butcher, and I remember as a kid, once his back was so bad, I had to put his socks and shoes on because he couldn't bend down. And then he went to work where he stood up for 18 hours. We're a bit of a kind of hardcore family when it comes to back issues. A lot of back issues in our family. But I remember when in my gap year, I injured my back. I already had a bad back, but then I further injured it. Because you know those rolling cages you get in supermarkets?
Yeah.
Somebody accidentally moved one, not seeing me, and it rammed right into my lower back. And it was getting to the, and I kept working on it because the thing was, we're coolings. We work through bad backs. And it was getting to the point, I was only 19. Just doing like a job to make some money on the side at Sainsbury's. It got to the point that the pain was spreading to my upper legs. And if anyone knows anything about backs, if the pain starts to be spread into your upper legs, that means you're in danger of having a slip disc. Yeah. And so I actually got told by my doctor, you basically need not to lift anything for a year. Otherwise, you're going to have really serious issues very soon. And my dad was genuinely annoyed. I'd let down my employer by going and asking for a change in duties, that didn't involve lifting anymore. And even like, it's only been recently as I've started to have to use the walking stick, if I have to walk for prolonged periods or stand for prolonged periods, that like I've been willing to say, okay, maybe this bad back is serious enough to qualify as a physical disability. But there is a part of me still deep down that goes, oh, you just got a bad back. You know, if you lost a bit of weight, this bad back would disappear. And I'm saying this as I can literally feel my neck is sore whilst turning my head round. So it's like the things that you kind of deal with in your own mind. And this is me as an EDI practitioner. Yeah, they never quite go away.
So that links us really nicely, actually, to that slightly nebulous word of reasonable, because part of the definition and part of the idea of the Equality Act 2010 is very much around reasonable adjustments. So I'm wondering if we want to just define what we think reasonable could be, and how that translates into what Will, myself, negotiate and look at when we do have people with disabilities, and where is the line, basically, to where it tips from being reasonable to unreasonable.
So, yeah, so this is where it gets murky, because this is a law. And so what is reasonable is based on case law. The Equality Act, as much as I love the Equality Act, and I think it is a very well written piece of legislation, you know, it's 12 years old now. Like, this is actually quite an old piece of legislation, and it hasn't really gone through the type of revisions you'd expect it to have gone through as people learn more about how it operates. So we are basically reliant on case law and what's been decided in judgments. But the rule of thumb is, if an adjustment for a disabled person, or indeed any protected characteristic, but if an adjustment is either A, going to tip over from leveling the playing field to giving that person unfair advantage, then it's probably illegal. Now, that's less true of disability, because things like the two tick scheme, where, you know, the old guaranteed interview scheme that we still have here in the trust, that there's actually an exception for that to be allowed. And like for certain jobs to be, you know, set aside for disabled people, you know, that's just still allowed, even in other circumstances that may be seen to be going from positive action to positive discrimination and therefore not being allowed. Then the more common things when it comes to disability are, is one, basically if it costs too much money, you know, we have a Tory government in post, they're not going to go around bankrupting businesses so businesses can employ disabled people. So if it's too much cost, if it's too difficult to do, it can be shut down as being unreasonable and an unreasonable adjustment. If it contravenes other laws or other requirements, it may be seen to be unreasonable. So a classic example that comes up a lot is, if you have a listed building, then you can get away with not complying to disability regulations. So, you know, me and a friend used to go to the Electric Cinema when I lived in Birmingham. The Electric Cinema has a upstairs screen, but no lift. And it's able to do that because it's a listed building, and it literally cannot bulldoze parts of its building to build a lift, because that would break the terms of it being a listed building. Therefore, they're allowed to have a screening upstairs with no disabled access to it. And then finally, if it would actually turn to change the nature of the service too much, or if it's decided that the issue somebody is facing isn't a substantial harm. So I'm going to give you an example of one I worked on previously. We in the previous organization, we had a question about how long a walk it was reasonable to make a disabled person get their lunch. So, you know, we had several sites. They were working at one site. They would have to walk to another site to get their lunch and return back to their office. And the determination we made is actually that was reasonable, because having a brief walk to get your lunch was an everyday thing you had to do. And there were other alternatives, such as bring your own lunch in, that could be done instead. So that's a brief overview of the type of things you consider. Okay, so not that brief.
There's two aspects to this as well, in addition, aren't there? So there's, I'm going to ask you to talk about this a little bit, Will. So there's the public sector duties under the Equality Act, which is slightly different for the NHS and other public sectors. So I'll ask you to expand on that a little bit. But so the reasonable bit is different, isn't it, for different sizes of organizations. So, for example, if we go down the butcher's route that you just mentioned your dad worked in, so if I'm a small family run butcher and I just employ a disabled colleague and they need an access and there needs to be a wheelchair ramp, it would not be reasonable necessarily, depending on the size of the business, for that to be a reasonable adjustment, whereas it would probably be unreasonable for an organization the size of the NHS for that not to be a reasonable adjustment. So, Will, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit around the difference between that and then the public duty bit.
Yes, it's on the. I'll take the second point first. It's a simpler one. It just goes by that inequalities law. The kind of the key word is proportionality. So what we do is meant to be proportional. It's meant to be proportional to the issues we encounter, the challenges we encounter, but it's also meant to be proportional to the capability, the capacity of the organization we work for. And so, yeah, like your example is very good. You know, a small butcher's, a small business, the cost of putting that ramp in may be more than they can afford. Whereas we, as a bigger organization, we could afford that. Obviously, as well, there is the difference between whether you're a service provider or whether you're just a workplace. Now, for example, you know, most of our sites are hospitals or community outreach centres where patients will be coming in. And that would mean that they have to be accessible to disabled patients, you know, people with mobility issues. And so those ramps you would expect to already be there. In terms of public sector equality duty, the key thing about that is it basically imposes on public sector bodies the responsibility to ensure that they are looking at their practice, particularly changes in their practice, and they are using that to advance equality and diversity, and definitely not to contribute negatively to equality and diversity. That will include discrimination against the various protected characteristics. Will also include things like fostering good relations between different communities. And the key thing about the public sector equality duty is it basically places an onus on public sector bodies to show they've shown due regard to these issues. This is often talked about as public sector bodies have to do equality impact assessments. That's not been true since around 2013. You don't have to do equality impact assessments. What you have to do is show due regard. Now, no one's came up with a better way of showing due regard than doing an equality impact assessment. So it basically evens out the same thing. As a public sector body, if we make changes in our policies or practice, if we make changes to our buildings, we have to have paperwork that shows we have actually considered the equality impact of what we're doing in a way a private sector body wouldn't have to. It basically just steel plates the responsibilities all organizations have in the Equality Act and means we actually consider things in more detail.
Dave?
Yeah, I'm bothered about sort of this sort of paperwork approach because, yeah, you can assess, and what bothers me is things often become tick box exercises. So yes, we've done the assessment and we've found, you know, because we've done the assessment, we're hunky dory. And you know, we've ticked that box. It doesn't necessarily say that you've done the assessment properly and that actually you've ticked that box correctly. So what worries me is organisations hiding behind the paperwork, not actually just getting on and putting the ramp in or whatever other adjustment may be needed.
I think my experience with equality impact assessments is people are too focused on the negative side of things, i.e. not discriminating. The whole point of the public sector equality duty is that don't discriminate bit is added to. You have the advance in equality of opportunity, you have the fostering of good relations, and so many times you see people who are doing a quality impact assessment and what they'll say is, oh yeah, there's no issues. What we're doing has no impact. And they think that means it's good. And it's like, well, no, you should be thinking about how we can use the change you're making to make positive change. Because of this public sector equality duty, we actually have a positive commitment, a positive duty, as well as the negative duty of don't do harm, don't discriminate.
Absolutely agree with that. I think it is important to think about that bureaucracy bit. And I think some are really good and some are not very good. And I agree. I see a lot of equality impact assessments where a lot of the boxes are said no impact. Let me play devil's advocate and maybe to both of you. So what would we say to somebody who would challenge us around we are sort of a nanny state, why are we doing all of these things? It makes no difference anyway. Sort of the old arguments around I treat everybody the same at interview anyway, so why should I treat somebody who is disabled arguably favorably by giving them a guaranteed interview, for example? So what would we argue and why would we argue that equality in respect to disability is important, and why would we value it in the way that we do?
So I'll give you an example. So like this week, the week we're recording, so this will be a month ago by the time people are listening to it, I did a brief shift helping put together the wellbeing packs that people are going to be sent by Sam's wellbeing team. And I did a couple of hours and it was fun. You know, it's a different thing to do, packing boxes, putting stuff in envelopes, very different to what I normally do in my job. But by the end of that 2 hours, my shoulder was extremely sore and even having gotten a chair, which, everybody else was standing whilst doing it, I had a chair. That is a reasonable adjustment. Sometimes they're that simple. Will needs a chair for him to do this, whereas everybody else can stand. My shoulder, my back was pretty sore. There is no doubt in my mind, if I had a more physically demanding job, my back would break down. Because I know when I was younger and I did have a more physically demanding job, my back did break down. So the reason why reasonable adjustments are important is you will get more out of your workers, your disabled workers, if you actually have those reasonable adjustments in place, if you are actually supporting your staff members. Again, with my mental health issues, I had a mental health relapse a couple of years ago. And actually, I got over that remarkably quickly, partially because my employer at the time actually was able to offer me some really beneficial, supportive things. Generous sick pay, more generous than what many people get, which meant I could take my time to get better. Access to a counselor for free. So I had like 6 free counseling sessions. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that meant I could go back to work and be productive and do my job. So at the most basic level, we're all here to work. The role of management is to ensure people work effectively, and reasonable adjustments are a way of ensuring people can be effective at work. It's not charity. This is to make people as productive as they can be.
I agree with that. Sorry, Dave, carry on.
Yeah, I agree. With me, we've got a bipolar mental health condition, so I'll be up and down on this sort of mood quite a lot. And if I'm struggling with a low mood, I may not be as productive. But by working with managers with that, when I sort of counteract it by doing more when I'm in a higher mood and I'm more productive. So it's sort of flexible work. And again, I don't sleep a lot because I've got a hyperactive brain. So I don't sleep a lot. So my hours of work will vary compared to some people. And I'll work in the middle of the night sometimes because that's when my brain's switched on. And it's that flexibility. So reasonable adjustments are quite a lot about thinking outside the box and none of those cost anything. It's not therapy or anything. It's just working with my mental health condition rather than against it.
I completely agree with you, and I think you say reasonable adjustments to our thinking out of the box, and you are absolutely right, because it is about being creative. It is about trying to look at how can we meet the needs of that particular member of staff in a way that's going to work ultimately for business continuity, i.e. make sure that things still work and tick over in the business, but also support that member of staff. So the way I would be thinking about it is, and the way I've explained it in the past, is for me, it's sort of leveling the playing field, for want of a better word. So for example, if you had somebody who, if I take myself, I'm dyslexic, so I will take slightly longer to read things, for example. So, Will, who we've seen type at supersonic speed, and I'm assuming reads very fast as well, would be able to do a piece of work relatively quickly, whereas it would take me longer. That doesn't mean that I can't do the piece of work, but the reasonable adjustments in my example might be that I would be given more time. Or there might be something in an interview process where it's leveling the playing field. So I might find that my concentration isn't as good, so I need to write things down more. So I would maybe be given more time to process things if I had ADHD or autism, for example. And those things could easily be accommodated in an interview, whereas somebody who doesn't have a disability wouldn't have that disadvantage. So therefore, the playing field needs to be leveled for people to be able to access and be able to function at the level that others do.
And I think that's the key word, though. It's leveled. We're not America, which just about still has affirmative action, which is, you know, going further than leveling the playing field of it in individual circumstances. Positive discrimination is illegal in this country with a few very isolated specific exceptions. And it's because is that what the government, what society has said is we want to level the playing field and no further. So like people shouldn't think of it as, oh no, someone's getting an undue advantage. Someone's being given favorable treatment. It's not that at all. It is solely about leveling the playing field and ensuring that a particular issue has a particular solution.
So if we go down that route, so if again, I'm going to play devil's advocate. So if we have a manager who is fair and equitable, they as a norm, don't grant reasonable adjustment, flexible working. So staff are expected to come in at a certain time, work their hours, and then go home at a certain time. So disabled member of staff comes, and let's use Dave's example, that maybe the morning is slightly more difficult, and you work through different hours. You know, you might be very tired, for example, and you might only wake up at 9 o'clock and not function that well at that time. So a reasonable adjustment would be to allow that flexibility. So we're assuming that business continuity isn't an issue. The argument from that manager could be that actually I haven't granted that privilege to anybody else, so why should I grant that privilege to Dave in this scenario?
Now, this is an interesting one. So I once worked with a consultant in my previous job that had the best line, which is good practice helps everyone. Bad practice particularly hurts women and minorities. Because actually, if the manager,
I like that.
If the manager has no good reason to deny people flexible working, they are screwing over so many people that work from people that have to do the school run, people that have long commutes, people that would rather work by themselves in quiet when they're writing a report, for example. If there's no actual reason for presenteeism, to get everybody into the office every day, to have everybody work in the same working pattern, that is just making everybody really miserable for no good reason. So, and now you look at they've forgotten this with how they've been at points during a pandemic, but the Conservative Party's manifesto in 2019 said they would bring in a statutory right to flexible working. So actually, you would have the right for flexible working, regardless of whether you're disabled or not, unless there's a reason why your workplace couldn't provide it. No, and what is called a sound business case. Now, let's steel man the scenario and say there actually is a reason, you know, like they do need at least somebody in the office at 10 a.m., 9:30 a.m. And so they've done a rota where everybody has to be the first one in once a week because that's fair. The argument I would say to that is if somebody cannot get in at 9:30, then they can't get in for 9:30. You shouldn't torture people. You shouldn't ignore their circumstances by just trying to impose a one size fits all approach. Like that's insane. Like you would never manage people in that way. If you were trying to get the most out of them. So no, if I was in that situation, you know, I would go to my team and say, you know, person X cannot come in at 9:30 in the morning. That is too early for them for good reasons. Can someone do the 9:30, a second 9:30 shift? And the person who isn't doing the 9:30 shift, they'll pick up your late shift. You know, this is part of being a manager. You know, you don't treat everybody the same, inverted commas. You tailor your approach to get the most out of the people you're managing.
I agree with that. Sorry, Dave.
Yeah, I'd agree. To the point where, I mean, 9:30 is actually quite late to open an office. So quite often it's a lot earlier than that.
That's true.
And getting in early to open an office when you've got an hour's drive to get there and you suffer from sleep deprivation could actually be dangerous.
And in some cases, it can just not be put. No, even like you're absolutely right, Dave, but sometimes it can be more profound than that. If somebody needs a care company to come and help them get dressed, they cannot leave until that care company has been. So if the person can't get the care company to arrive until 8, then they may not be able to get into the office for 9:30 due to no fault of their own. It's just the way the care, though, what the service that they need to support them can be provided. And then this is a type of empathy that people need to have in the workplace.
Yeah, empathy and soft management skills. I think I haven't mentioned this word before, but the type of management I cannot stand and doesn't work for me is micromanagement. And if you micromanage the wrong people, someone with a mental health condition, it can totally rebound and, destroy that person and therefore lose you a lot of productivity as a result. So you've got to think about management styles.
I completely agree with that. I think I've supported many colleagues in the past with reasonable adjustments and very, very simple things like allowing somebody whose normal working hours might be 8:30 till 4:30 or 9 till 5. A degree of flexibility within that first hour actually meant that they were far more productive and actually were doing more than they were doing beforehand. So I think there has to be a pragmatic part in this, doesn't it? That business continuity has to be considered. That is without a shadow of a doubt. The first and foremost thing that needs to be thought about. However, the creative bit, the thinking out of the box bit, Dave, that you mentioned beforehand in these discussions has to be the thing that we think about when we think about reasonable adjustments. And unfortunately, a lot of the time they aren't. So I think it's really incumbent on us as staff network to promote that. I think we have the disability, the Business Disability Forum now as an access point as well for managers to tap into, who can help with some of this. As reps, we help with the those kind of notions on a daily basis. Will's team will also be thinking about those kind of things on a daily basis. So I think there's a lot of resources that people can tap into, and obviously HR colleagues as well, if you need help with this or if you want any support with this. So I've found this a very interesting discussion and a fascinating discussion. So is there anything else anybody wants to talk about before we close down?
So, yeah, I'll just say one thing, which is, I think, important, which is anyone listening to this, if you ever do feel that because of, you know, mental or physical pain that you're in, that you need support, reasonable adjustment, just come to us and ask for the support. You know, you don't have to self-define as disabled. It doesn't work in a way where you only get access to this support. You only get access to these rights. Once you kind of say that, yes, I am disabled, everyone can self-define as they so choose, but you still have the rights and the support based on your circumstances. So, you know, don't feel afraid to come forward and see whether there's something we can do to support you. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if we can't, we'll say so. So come forward. We'll always try our best to support you. And, you know, we would not want people, you know, in pain, mentally or physically, going without the support they need because they don't ask.
Absolutely agree with that. And the nature of reasonable adjustments doesn't have to be this is something that is in place forever and ever and ever. So if there are conditions that are transient, reasonable adjustments would still apply. So completely agree.
And also, we should also say, as I mentioned before, the Equality Act is a bit long in the tooth. It has evolved with case law. If you are caring for a disabled person, there is also scope for you to claim for reasonable adjustments as well. They won't necessarily be the same as what a disabled person can would receive, but you know, you can ask for reasonable adjustments, and the same thing kicks in due to your association with a disabled person. You are protected by the Equalities Act.
Yeah. So if you have a dependent, a child who suffers a disability, you would still be covered. Absolutely. And the other thing just to say before we close down, and I promise this is the last thing, and if you've stuck with us, well done for 40 minutes or however long it's been, is that if you have a disability and there are things that are secondary to your disability, those are still covered. So, for example, if I have a low immune system because I have cancer, for example, or AIDS, if I have frequent colds or I'm prone to infections, things like that, those secondary symptoms are still covered under the Equality Act. Okay, so, well, thank you both for joining. It's been a fantastically interesting afternoon on this still sunny afternoon, and we'll hopefully see you at the next podcast, and thanks for sticking with us. See you soon.
Bye, bye everyone.
Cheers, bye.